Peter Stansky teaches history at Stanford University. We have a link on againstthegrain.org to one of his many books about William Morris. It's called Redesigning the World, William Morris, the 1880s and the Arts and Crafts. He also published, among other things, a biography of William Morris. Well, you said that in the beginning in the 1870s, William Morris took a turn to leftist politics, to socialist politics. He joined, I believe, among other things, the Social Democratic Federation, which was a socialist political party established in 1881. In 1884, he founded the Socialist League, became editor of its journal, Commonweal. It could be somewhat obvious to listeners by now why he turned towards socialism, but what was his primary motivation in getting into politics and trying to make his impact there, in addition to all the other impacts he was making in various parts?
Yes, because what we haven't mentioned is that in his own day, and far less so now, in his own day, he was perhaps most famous as a poet. He was extremely, extremely well-known a poet. He wrote these long poems quite a few volumes, The Earthly Paradise. His earlier poems are really the best. And there's still intense scholarly interest in that. And he wrote all through his life. I mean, he was unbelievably prolific. But in the 1870s, he became interested in what was known as the Eastern Question, the whole issue in the Balkans and the role of the Turks. And he began rather conventionally in the sense that he supported William Gladstone, who was the liberal leader and liberal prime minister, who was anti-Turkish, in favor of self-determination for the people in the Balkans. And he was treasurer. I mean, he was quite well off, and he supplied money for a lot of these endeavors. But he felt that conventional politics was not going to change the world, and that it was necessary in order to have good design, which was his beginning motivation. But he became increasingly convinced, and in a way he was rather had mixed feelings about his disciples, because he became increasingly convinced that in order for good design to triumph, and the purpose of good design was for people to live better lives, that there would have to be fundamental political change. So indeed, he began to read Marx. He read Das Kapital in French, and his copy is now, I think, in the Morgan Library. He became a socialist. Indeed, he became a communist. And he really was not in. He was in favor. At first, he thought there could be gradual change. But he became more and more convinced, and of course, this on this station, I presume this has resonance. If it's appropriate to say so, he became more and more convinced that there needed to be radical change. In many ways, he was not a parliamentary. He did not believe, even though in many ways Britain was obviously a democracy, he believed that their vested interests was so strong that conventional politics, he became, and, you know, people who are most interested in his design aspects are sometimes uncomfortable with this or don't wish to accept Morris as a revolutionary. At first, he thought that there could be change within the system. He participated in, I've forgotten the exact year, in a very important riot that took place in Trafalgar Square that was stopped with some brutality, and one man was killed, some brutality by the police. He became convinced that only a physical revolution would bring about the change that was necessary. And he outlines this he outlines the utopia that he hoped to happen in many ways his greatest prose work called News from Nowhere. Nowhere, of course, being the translation of the word utopia. And he has, in that book, he has Parliament. The buildings of Parliament have become a collection place for manure, for fertilizer, which in a way sort of shows his estimate of the traditional political system. The trouble is that Morris, though he was committed to fellowship, very, very strongly. He was committed to cooperation, but yet the paradox, as I've said, and he was sometimes referred to as the earthly paradox of his way of operating, is that it was very difficult for him to actually operate with a group. So though the Socialist Democratic Federation, which you mentioned, was very important as an ancestor for the Labour Party, in Morris's view, it was too parliamentary. So he left it, and he became a member, and as you say, a founding member of the Socialist League, where Eleanor Marx, Marx's daughter, was very important. And Morris felt that that was too anarchic and anarchist. And so he was unhappy with that. So he ended up with his own group, the Hammersmith Socialist Society. So he, in terms of the actual mechanics of a revolution, it was hard for him to work that out. But as a theorist, as in his writings, and also, I mean, he put his body where his ideas were. He every Sunday, while he was still in good health, he would walk down a couple of blocks from his house, London House, to the Hammersmith Bridge, and he'd preach. He'd preach socialism. I mean, he gave these wonderful, wonderful talks about what was wrong with British society, that here this great, rich society and so many people were living in poverty.
We're talking about William Morris, one of the key founders of the arts and crafts movement, which began in Britain in the 1880s, then spread to continental Europe and then to America from about 1890 to 1916, and ended up in Japan for about 20 years in the early part of the 20th century. The show is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. My guest is Peter Stansky, joins us in studio. I have heard William Morris referred to as the reactionary revolutionary, and I wonder what you think of that label, whether you agree with it at all. I think maybe some of that label refers to his nostalgia for maybe pre-industrial society. But there's also, I guess, something I read about an event or events that Morris heard or witnessed which convinced him that the time was not ripe for socialist revolution, that English society and government at the time was not ready. And of course, that wouldn't make you necessarily reactionary, but I wonder what happened to his politics after that moment.
Well, no, I wouldn't agree with that. I mean, I know what's meant by a reaction, that why he's what might be called a reactionary socialist. And I think that refers to the medievalism. In my view, this is a very common thread in British thought, where there's and characteristics, say, of George Orwell, who's been called a Tory radical, and E.P. Thompson, to a degree, maybe not, but many others, in this emphasis on looking backwards, this sort of that there was a golden age in the past, which we might want to recreate. So I think that's one reason that that title might be applied to him. But I think he realized it was sort of a model, part of which could be used. I think he's also sometimes called a reactionary socialist, in the sense that he was a very successful businessman, and people say, well, you know, if you're a socialist, why are you running a business, a capitalist business? Morris, I think, had an excellent answer to that, in that if he didn't have profit sharing with his workers, and it could be said that his workers weren't, that their work, although I think they were fairly comfortable, particularly at Merton Abbey, where his factory was, but it was not a socialist enterprise, and he realized that in the context of the time, A, that wouldn't happen, and B, although he had a private income for much of his life, towards the last 20 years or so, that was much diminished. In order to fight the system, he had to have an income. in order to support the Commonweal, the publication of the Socialist League, he had to have money. So indeed, and this again, this tradition of well-off radicals and socialists, which makes the British sometimes being accused of hypocrisy, is there. But if he had changed his business and hadn't made a profit, it wouldn't have brought the revolution any closer, and he himself would have been much less effective participant in the revolution. Now, at the end of towards the end of his life, he and particularly starting in the very late 1880s, his last great enterprise, which we haven't even mentioned, but of course is fantastically important, was the Kelmscott Press, which was incredibly crucial in determining the look of the, although you might not think it looking at those books, but incredibly important in determining the look of the modern book and also the private press movement. He became a much more serious collector of early printed books, but his health was in very poor shape. He no longer had the, and he died, of course, comparatively young. He was only 62. He did not have the physical strength to continue to go to the Hammersmith Bridge, to continue to go around the country giving political lectures. But in my view, he did not change one iota. Mm. And I think he remained convinced that there had to be a violent revolution in order to change the country. And I think he never abandoned, he wasn't in cells sort of planning. He was in no sense a terrorist. He wasn't planning physical assaults, but he thought that there would ultimately have to be an uprising in order to change the society. And in my view, he never abandoned that belief.
We have a few minutes left. You referred earlier to his critique of mass machine-based production. Were there limits to his critique of that? Did he understand or acknowledge that there had to be this kind of production kind of society?
I think Morris is frequently misconstrued. Particularly also to make his wallpapers and his cloths available. A lot of them were manufactured, outsourced, to use the ghastly new word, Gerald and Company. I've got the names of the firms, or Sanderson, which still manufactures them today, and I think began to do so early. He was anti-machine in some sense, but he was not anti-machine as a tool. He and his followers, in my view, particularly given the context of British history, his followers, I think, tended to be more anti-machine than Morris was. And I think it was partially for the quality of the work, but it was partially also a class issue that the small firms, the small and very important design firms that I discuss in Redesigning the World, that were founded very much under Morris's influence, did not want to deal with commerce and trade. They wanted to emphasize the individual work that was work for gentlemen. So the class and gentle ladies, particularly in embroidery, and the class aspect of that was very important. The class aspect was not important for Morris. Morris was perfectly happy, in my view, to use the machine as a tool, but not as a dominating force. And, of course, there's a famous essay by Frank Lloyd Wright. And Frank Lloyd Wright, as an arts and crafts person, is an appropriate terminal for the exhibition, is an ambiguous figure. And he wrote this famous essay of a talk he gave in Chicago called The Arts and Crafts of the Machine. And the whole business of the arts and crafts influence upon modernism, of course, is to have the arts and crafts ethos done by machines. And Morris was sympathetic to that. He's misrepresented, I think, in my view. He just felt the machine has to be watched very carefully, but it certainly can be used.
Peter Stansky, Emeritus Professor of History at Stanford University. His books include a biography of William Morris entitled William Morris and Redesigning the World, William Morris, the 1880s and the Arts and Crafts. You can find links to that book on our website, againstofthegrain.org, as well as a link to the current and ongoing exhibition of International Arts and Crafts, William Morris to Frank Lloyd Wright, at the de Young Museum in San Francisco. I think it runs through June 18th. Thanks so much for joining us today, Peter.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And Sasha and I will look for you next time.